Standing on the sidelines waving the 1951 convention is not a solution. We risk being completely marginalized and being declared irrelevant. I've lost count of the number of times I've gone into a meeting with a minister and he said, oh, here comes UNHCR with another problem. And this is what I keep telling my colleagues. When you're going into a discussion with the government, don't go in with just the problem, go in with a solution that you know they are prepared to envisage. Remember to walk a mile in their shoes, because you have to understand where they're coming from if you're going to be able to advocate properly.
Protection leadership means ensuring that the safety, the dignity, and the rights of the people affected by humanitarian crises guide every decision we make. Humanitarian leaders in field operations need to work together to advocate and to keep attention firmly on those most at risk. Protection is everybody's business. Hello, everyone, and welcome. I am Panos Fumsis, your host for the Protection Leadership Podcast. Welcome to episode one. This series is all about cutting through the jargon and getting real about what protection leadership actually looks like. The decision, the dilemmas, the courage, and the leadership it takes to stand up for people at risk. So I'm genuinely thrilled to kick off with someone who has shaped protection thinking for years. Reuven Menigdiwella, the Assistant High Commissioner for Refugees, responsible for protection. Reuven has worked in some of the toughest operations, and her insights always cut straight to the heart of what matters. Reuven, welcome. What a delight to have you with us. Thank you for joining us. I wanted to ask you, Reuven, when we talk about protection leadership for UNHCR, what it actually looks like? What does it mean?
Well, first of all, thanks a lot for inviting me to your podcast, Panos. This is really an interesting experience for me. Listen, when you're talking about protection leadership at this point in time in UNHCR, it's almost an existential question. And I honestly never thought I'd ever say that. But in my 30 plus years of working with UNHCR, for the first time, we are now hearing member states, including ones that are traditionally our allies, actually questioning the relevance of the 1951 convention. They're basically saying, oh, look, this is a convention that was drafted in the 20th century. It's really not fit for purpose for the kinds of situations we're encountering in the 21st century. And of course, our position to that is absolutely not. The convention has saved millions of lives in the past. It will continue to save millions of lives in the future. What possibly needs to be modified are the implementation frameworks that were put in place by member states in order to implement the obligations under the convention. That certainly has to be looked at. Many of them are clearly not fit for purpose because they were established in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, or even 80s. And in the 21st century, these processes may be really resource intensive, cumbersome, and not really meeting the current needs. For us, that's really a critical question.
Wow, that's really worrying to hear that this is the state of where we are. But exactly when you talk to these governments or to these responsible officials, can you give them like one example of why this is important, why protection leadership can save lives, or what would you tell them to demonstrate exactly the importance of it with one real example maybe?
Right. In many cases, you're talking to governments that know absolutely the importance of protection. These are not, you know, our government interlocutors are the ministers of justice, of home affairs, the ministers of interior. They deal with these issues on a daily basis and they know what humanitarian obligations are about. But it's more putting it in a light that they understand, which is a political light. And I keep saying perceptions are even more important than reality sometimes. I was just recently in Greece, in Crete. At the time I was there, the Greek government had suspended all asylum processing of asylum seekers coming via North Africa. That suspension has been lifted now, but that at that point it was still in place. So I went to Crete to see for myself the situation there. And then what I found was essentially the Hellenic Coast Guard had just rescued a boatload of people. And I went to this reception center where these people were being housed, and I was looking at these groups, and I realized they were almost evenly divided between Sudanese asylum seekers who had crossed through via Libya to Crete. They had previously stayed in Eastern Chad, in Egypt, in South Sudan, and because they could not find the services they required in these countries, they had decided to take these incredibly dangerous journeys to try and access asylum in Europe. But along with them, there was a huge number of young Egyptian men, young lads who were clearly looking for economic opportunities in Greece. Now, all of them were going to be applying for asylum. The Sudanese, absolutely, they had the most compelling claims for seeking refuge. But the Egyptians, principally, and they were quite open to me about it, they were going to be applying for asylum because that was the only way they could remain in Greece and earn a bit of money while their claims were being processed. And that should not be happening. And we understand. So when I'm talking to the Greek government, it is in full recognition of the fact that they do have a problem, that many migrants are abusing the asylum systems in order to be able to stay in the country, and that this is their problem. It's not so much the bona fide refugees. They're not at all concerned with that. They understand that they have a clear obligation. And the Minister of the Interior, when I spoke to him, said that. He said, of course, we understand that for the Sudanese, the South Sudanese, the Eritreans, which are the big nationalities from refugee-producing countries coming into Greece, he said, we understand that we have to process them, that we have to grant them refugee status, and all the rights that come with that. But he said, our problem is the Egyptians. What do we do with that? Why are you not helping us with that? So when we are talking to asylum authorities, host governments, particularly in the global north, in the high-income countries, this is the discourse we have to say, look, we understand that you have a real problem, that you have just as many migrants abusing the asylum systems as real bona fide asylum seekers seeking refugee status. And we understand that you have to deal with both of them. And here are the methods by which you can do that. Accelerated processing, differentiated processing for manifestly unfounded claims, fast-tracking them, not allowing them to remain for years in your country. And once they're found not to be in need of international protection, a prompt and effective way of returning them to their countries of origin. And we are prepared to help you with all of these different scenarios and all of these different situations. So that's really, it's about going to talk to a government, understanding the problem, but going with a solution as well. Because going to them and protesting, saying, oh my goodness, you cannot suspend, you know, asylum processing for asylum seekers coming from North Africa is not going to resolve the problem. But it's more telling them, we understand you have a problem, that your concern is not really people coming from refugee-producing countries, it's people coming from countries that are producing predominantly migrants, and your concern is really how to tell the distinction between the two and how to deal with both expeditiously, and we are there for that.
Wow. And really, the distinction between the migrants and the refugees is critical, because while everybody should be treated with dignity and respect, the refugees, should they go back, their life could be a danger. While the migrants, it's a different situation. So
exactly. And the institution of asylum should never be a backdoor for migration. And we have always said that, and we will continue to say that, because that is also where the credibility of the institution of asylum lies.
Yeah, no, very clear. Reuven, I'd like to take you to a country operation, a field operation, where in the country there is a mixed situation where you have IDPs, internally displaced people, and refugees. So I wanted to ask you the role of the UNHCR representative in this mixed situation. Clearly, the refugee mandate falls squarely, then you have the IDPs. How can the rep lead protection in this situation? What would it look like practically?
That's an interesting question, Panos, because right now we're actually reviewing all of these different situations within the context of the Interagency Standing Committee, because of the fact that we have a plethora of coordination processes right now. We have the refugee coordination model, we have the cluster system, and then we also have other context-specific coordination systems that are put in place, like in Lebanon and other countries. So what the Emergency Relief Coordinator has basically said is, look, we need to, and along with all of us, because our High Commissioner is completely in agreement, we have to really get rid of this plethora of different coordination systems, some of which don't speak to each other, or some of which are even in conflict with each other. That was the genesis for the humanitarian reset that is taking place right now, along with other reforms that are more UN proper, like the UNAIDS. The humanitarian reset is essentially for humanitarian agencies within the context of the IAC. And what the humanitarian reset says in terms of coordination in mixed situations is, look, before we had two coordination systems, one for the refugees, one for the IDPs. And as I said, they did not necessarily speak to each other. And then what you did have was agencies, particularly protection agencies, running from one coordination meeting relating to clusters to another coordination meeting relating to refugees, and sometimes on exactly the same issues, whether it's on child protection, education, shelter, income generating opportunities. All of these things have been discussed in both of these systems, but without ever speaking to each other. So basically, some of the small agencies were going like, wait a minute, we are spending our entire time sitting in meetings to the detriment of protection delivery on the ground, and this has got to stop. So The humanitarian reset is all about ensuring in a mixed situation, if the situation is a predominantly IDP one, then the cluster activation would, the global protection cluster would then encompass not just the IDPs, but also the refugee situations, with UNHCR clearly in the lead because this is a refugee situation, but with the coordination systems being streamlined so that you did not have two separate systems that don't speak to each other. If, on the other hand, it is a predominantly refugee situation, then it's a refugee coordination model that kicks in. And it's basically, you know, the traditional UNHCR responsibilities. We are the provider of, we are the first port of call and the provider of last resort as well. So it's really trying to cut back on coordinations, which also in this day and age are becoming incredibly expensive. And as you know, the entire humanitarian community is in dire financial straits. So we really have to see how much we can streamline this and focus on impact and delivery rather than sitting around in meeting rooms talking endlessly to each other, whether it's on the refugees or whether it's on the IEPs.
Yeah. No, simplifying processes, it's something that is very welcome. If anything, we have become too heavy or too big as a system to take it over. You also mentioned the humanitarian reset. So is protection at the center of the reset? Surely when we cannot do everything, shouldn't protection be kind of really one of the core activities that take us to move forward?
Absolutely. And this is where centrality of protection comes in. This is almost a mantra in the IASC. Everybody, all of the principal, the heads of agencies in the IASC mentioned that. And as you know, every year we have protection champions, you know, which was initially led by the High Commissioner, et cetera. So each of the principals takes it in turn to be a protection champion as well. But what it means is, and we really do have to demystify this, because when you talk about centrality of protection, particularly people who are not from a protection background, their eyes tend to glaze over and they're going like, oh my God, here come the lawyers again. And you really have to demystify it. When you're looking at a camp layout, when you're putting lighting, when you're ensuring that sections of the camp where the women are accommodated have strong lighting, that the latrines have to be close to where they are being accommodated, that's protection. That's not just camp layout. So when you're looking at shelter, when you're prioritizing women, you know, single heads of households or particularly vulnerable refugees or IDPs, that's protection. When you're talking about access to education for children, whether it's young adolescents or extremely young children, again, that's protection. Because we all know that without a proper guiding framework, particularly for adolescents, if they're running around with absolutely nothing to guide them, nothing to frame them, they are going to be vulnerable to either radicalization, criminalization, they join gangs, or they are forcibly recruited into armed groups, or they become, constricted into the labor market. So education then becomes a protection tool, just as much as shelter is, just as much as health is. We have to ensure that people, you know, those particularly vulnerable, the disabled, et cetera, have access to the kinds of services they require. Survivors of GBV, that they have access to, you know, the services that they need. All of this is protection, even though it can be couched as, again, access to health services, access to medical services, access to education, access to shelter. So that is where the centrality of protection is. It's not talking endlessly about legal principles. It's actually making sure that protection drives whatever strategy is on the ground and that all of these different activities, programs that we put in place have a protection outcome, that women and children are protected, that people with specific needs, like the disabled and the elderly, have programs that cater to their needs, that young men are not left without any guidance. So every strategy, every activity has to have a protection outcome, that it leads in, at the end of the day, to enhance protection for these people. That is what the centrality of protection is. It's not esoteric principles, you know, contained in a book. It's literally what you're doing on a day-to-day basis for these people.
Thank you for shedding light and demystifying with concrete examples. You gave several of these examples. I want to ask you on the centrality of protection, how about the resident humanitarian coordinator who leads the operations for the whole system, including the NGOs, everybody else in the country? And how about the senior management team, the humanitarian country team in country? How can they help? What can they do besides or in addition to the putting in operations that you described in order really to kind of have the protection concerns of the most critical and vulnerable people at the top of their agenda to advocate and move them forward? What can they do?
You know, that's a great question. And I think with the UN reform, the one that was started, you know, at the onset of the current Secretary General's mandate, what was one of the positive changes was the empowerment of the RCHCs, as you know, and the fact that they are now that there has been a disconnect between UNDP, which traditionally used to host the RCs, and, you know, the current system where the RCs, HCs report directly to the Secretary General by way of the DSG, the Deputy Secretary General. What this has led to is resident coordinators and humanitarians with a far more diverse background than has been the case in the past, including many who come from humanitarian, you know, agencies, from UNICEF, from UNHCR, from WFP, etc. So they already have a plus in the sense that they are used to dealing with humanitarian operations. They understand the criticality of protection. They understand what needs to be done. That's great. But at the same time, they're not going to be doing this alone. The coordination in the country team, the HCT and the UNCT, is absolutely primordial. That has to happen. All of the heads of agencies have to be singing from the same song sheet. And we've seen the problems it can create when they don't, when each of these agencies are heading off in a different direction, and the RCHC, if he or she is double hatting, really has problems pulling them all back together. So one coordinated central strategy that encompasses all of these different elements on protection. The second is understanding that you're not going to be able to do everything for everybody everywhere all at once, that you have to prioritize, particularly in today's world where funding is such a key issue, which is now beginning to dominate everything we do. Then you have to pick at least two or three key priorities or key activities and to do them well. And this is something that we have been doing from the onset in operations like Ukraine, UNHCR, and Ukraine, as you probably know, is one of our best funded situations. For all the obvious reasons, it's in Europe's backyard. You know, a lot of the European member states have a stake in what's happening. So our operations in Ukraine have always been extremely well funded. So the temptation was there for us to go in and say, look, we've got hundreds of millions of dollars. So let's go in and start doing everything for these poor Ukrainians who are internally displaced in their country. But right from the start, our representative and the High Commissioner said, no, you're not going to. We are going to focus on two or three key activities that are going to be at the core of what needs to be done. And we're going to focus on that, and we let other agencies do what else needs to be done. But we focus on these three priorities, and we are going to just focus on that. So for us, it was protection, shelter, and cash-based interventions. And we stuck to that, though even at times a lot of the other agencies and even the government came to us and said, do you mind helping us out with, you know, other sectors? And we were going like, you know what? There are other agencies that are much better equipped than we are to do this. We would really prefer to focus our energies and really our priorities on these three areas. So and that's a lesson also for RCs, HCs. The temptation is there to try and do everything, and no agency, no team is ever going to be able to do that. And so that has to be the starting point, that the entire team gets together and understands these are the three or four key priorities that we as a team are going to be focusing on. And yeah, this is what each individual agency within those priorities is going to undertake.
No, prioritization at this time is more crucial than ever before.
Absolutely.
Including for a humanitarian country team, both in program, but also in advocacy, to be able to reach top government officials or whoever it takes to make it happen. On the advocacy side, some critics look at us, look at our sector, and think that we have become far too risk averse. We are no longer kind of willing to step up to talk about sensitive issues, about vulnerable groups or situations in a country that situation is complex and is really not easy. So my question to you, is this true? What's your kind of reflection on the sector? And how can leaders at the country level take a principled approach where we put the most vulnerable of the people to the very front of what we're doing?
First, I would strongly contest that assertion that we are actually risk averse. We are not. We are actually taking more risks now than we have ever done in our 75-year history. But I think I do understand where some of these critiques are coming from because of the fact that we have evolved along with the rest of the world. When the 1951 Convention was formulated, the world was a completely different place. There was a Cold War going on. We knew who the good people were. You know, it was a very black and white situation. A lot of the asylum processes that were set up, as I said previously, were, you know, meant for small groups of people with very strong claims coming to these countries applying for asylum, because international travel was not within the reach of a lot of people. It was literally only a handful of people who could afford to cross international borders, particularly to go into high-income countries. So many of these processes were set up for a different time, a different population. That's not the case now. I mean, we did not have, you know, people traffickers and people smugglers with lucrative businesses flourishing in those days that we have now. And we did not have people who basically with a few dollars in their pockets can now cross international borders. That was just unthinkable in those days. That's the situation we are facing now. We also have protracted refugee situations now that we did not have in the 1950s. Even when I joined UNHCR 30 plus years ago, the life cycle of a refugee situation was essentially about 5 to 10 years at most. Now we're looking at protracted situations. I was just in the Western Sahara in Algeria just last week. That, along with the Palestinian refugee situation, is possibly one of the world's oldest ones. They just marked the 50th anniversary of displacement, which is possibly the most horrendous milestone you can think of. But there they are. And the last time I visited Algeria was 20 years ago. And it was heartbreaking for me to realize that some of the refugees I was speaking to last week were kids who were running around 20 years ago in that same camp, and they're still there, you know, a generation later. So displacement has become more protracted, which means that host governments, particularly, as we know, 75% of the world's refugees are being hosted in low-income and middle-income countries, not in high-income countries. These people, these governments bear the brunt of it. And we need to look at ways of alleviating that responsibility, the whole issue of burden sharing. These were not concepts that you even thought of in the 1950s. You know, these are things that emerged in the 75 years now. And the Global Compact on Refugees in 2018 actually recognized that. They put a lot of emphasis on the importance of the responsibilities being borne by host countries, particularly low-income and middle-income countries, the need for refugees to be self-reliant because of the fact that now they were not looking at solutions 10 years down the road. They could be living in a refugee camp for 50 years without a solution. That meant they had to become self-reliant because humanitarian assistance is going to dry up. No donor is going to keep paying money for decades. For the first decade, for the, you know, the first couple of decades, maybe. After that, they're telling UNHCR, you know what? You need to look at other ways of doing this because we are not going to keep funding this refugee situation where we don't see any changes happening at all. You're just creating dependency on the part of the refugees. And you're basically asking us to keep paying without any solutions in sight. So you, UNHCR, you have to look at this differently. So this is why we're looking at all of these different approaches now. And they do involve out-of-the-box thinking. And this, I can understand that some of the more conservative elements, both within and outside UNHCR, are going like, wait, what a minute. This is not the UNHCR I knew of the 1990s, you know. Yes, we evolve along with refugee situations, along with the rest of the world. Refugee law does not. The principles stand. But how we interpret those principles, how we apply those principles are done much more pragmatically now because of the different, very different humanitarian situations that emerge now. Now, from the onset of a humanitarian crisis, we're talking about inclusion of refugees, both in legal frameworks, you know, in terms of making sure the governments try to register them rather than us. That from the minute they're there, we try to ensure that they're included in government services, in public services, in the host countries, and that they're not going to be dependent on humanitarian assistance. That whatever humanitarian assistance is being provided should go to reinforcing government services, whether it's health, education, or shelter, that it's actually, or housing. So it's actually the governments from the start incorporating refugees into their national services, rather than refugees being heavily dependent for 30, 40 years on, you know, international humanitarian assistance, which now, as we all know, is drying up very rapidly. So these are the different kinds of approaches we are looking at. And in the protection domain as well, before, and I mentioned this previously, part of what makes an asylum system effective is ensuring that people whose asylum claims have resulted in a negative decision are returned promptly to where they came from. Because if your asylum systems determine they're not refugees, but then they're able to stay in that country, you know, for 20 years because of the inability of that country to return them to their countries of origin, they are going to constitute a pull factor for other migrants as well. Because those are going to say, oh, wait a minute, these people have actually, you know, turned down for refugee status, but they managed to stay for about 15 more years earning money because of the fact that the government couldn't return them. So, hey, we should be doing it too. So we realized from the start that we need to be much more proactive than we have been in the past in terms of assisting governments with returning people who have no international protection needs. In the past, we always said, look, if they're not refugees, government, you deal with it bilaterally with the countries of origin. As far as we are concerned, they're not refugees. So we are not really going to be helping you with that part of it, you know, because they're migrants, so they don't fall within our mandate. Now we are saying we realize that in order for the asylum systems to be effective, we also need to be addressing that part of it. And bear in mind, Panos, that last year, out of the totality of asylum claims that were processed, 45% resulted in negative decisions. That means almost 50% of people accessing asylum processes had no business being in that system at all because they were essentially migrants or people with other reasons for applying for asylum, which were not related to international protection at all. But that meant that, you know, that 45% needed to be returned. And we needed to assist these governments in doing that in order to ensure, to protect the institution of asylum and to protect these asylum processes themselves. You know, that's a new terrain for us. We are saying, no, you know, we are prepared to, under these conditions, endorse return hubs for people who cannot be returned immediately or directly to their countries of origin. We said, fine, they can be transferred to another country, into a hub, where they could wait pending their return to their countries of origin. Under these circumstances, you know, if these conditions are met, we have no problem with these return hubs being established in third countries. And under these conditions, we would be, even on a good officer's basis, be prepared to assist you in this regard. Same thing with lawful transfers. Before, you know, we would not have really been proactive. But now we realize, and while we are still not promoting it, we realize that lots of governments now, the United States, but not just the United States, a lot of European governments as well, are going bilaterally to other countries and saying, we want to transfer asylum seekers who are coming to our countries to your countries. And we are going like, we are not promoting this, but we are prepared to get involved in this as long as certain fundamental requirements are met, which is, for example, you, the sending country in Europe, you still have to maintain responsibility for these people, even if you transfer them to another country. So very different from the UK-Rwanda deal, which, if you recall, Panos, was essentially the UK saying, Rwanda, please take all of these people and we really don't care what happens next. Here we are saying, fine, you can transfer them, but then you still bear responsibility to ensure that A, the receiving country has an adequate asylum process by which these people's claims can be looked at. And if these people are found to be refugees, that proper solutions are found for them. And you, as a sending country, have a responsibility to contribute to those solutions. And you, as a sending country, also has a responsibility to financially support the receiving country in order to ensure and maintain these systems are set up, these people are properly accommodated with minimum standards of treatment, and that you are also financially contributing to their solutions should integration in that receiving country be the solution.
Wow.
So these are all new things. I mean, even 15 years ago, we would not have gone into this. But we realize the world is moving on and we need to move along with it. So I would strongly contest us being risk averse. In fact, we are taking more risks now than we have done in the past. But that is because we realized standing on the sidelines waving the 1951 Convention is not a solution. We risk being completely marginalized and being declared irrelevant. And I've got to tell you, Panos, I've lost count of the number of times I've gone into a meeting with a minister and he said, oh, here comes UNHCR with another problem. And this is what I keep telling my colleagues. When you're going into a discussion with the government, don't go in with just the problem, go in with a solution. And go in with a solution that you know they are prepared to envisage. You know, when my law professors said this, you know, when I was studying law, and they said, when you're looking at your opponent, remember to walk a mile in their shoes. Mm. Because you have to understand where they're coming from if you're going to be able to advocate properly. And yes, we have to be clear in our messaging. We have to be consistent in our messaging. We do have to be courageous because there are times when we speak up when we're, you know, and it's a wildly unpopular thing to do. But that's what we're all about. This is us. You know, refugee protection is our existential, it's our raison d'etre. Right? Without that, we don't, you know, we'd be just another humanitarian agency.
Wow. It's really fascinating to hear about this adaptation kind of to the changing context, to the changing world, to the changing also financial reality that, as you mentioned, that we see on the ground. Surely one would like to see also more change in the root causes, which is really the main reason kind of a lot of these things happen and have impact. And one hopes obviously to see more a peaceful solution, which would impact both refugees and migration actually on this issue.
Exactly. And this policy is also what the root-based approach is all about. A lot of the issues I highlighted are, you know, responded to through that approach. One is prevention, and this is literally it. We do have a mandate responsibility to not, to create conditions in the countries of origin that are conducive to the safe and dignified and voluntary return of refugees. So that means we do need to focus on countries of origin as well, both in terms of sustainable return, but also prevention, to prevent people from being forced to flee in the first place. That being said, though, and the High Commissioner says this all the time, we are not the political actors. We are the humanitarian actors. We can look at how to make refugee returns sustainable in the countries of origin, which hopefully will then also lead to, you know, deterring further outflows from those same countries. But at the end of the day, these are political solutions that lie at the heart of these problems. And that's not our remit. That has to be the government's doing it. And humanitarian action should never be an excuse for political inaction. And we see that happening a lot right now. Practically every situation, including Sudan, donors giving us money, not a lot, I have to admit, but giving us money saying, well, you know, we can't solve the problem, but here's a bit of money for you to provide a Band-Aid. And that's exactly what it is. You know, at the end of the day, we are providing a Band-Aid. The real solution has to be a political one where the concerned actors get together and actually arrive at a solution. So prevention is important, but humanitarian action pending, you know, solutions is also, you know, is a critical thing, obviously.
Reuven, when we look at the news every day, when we watch the news, the picture is grim. From Darfur to Gaza to Ukraine, we see protection of civilians, even protection of humanitarian workers being absolutely not respected. We've had the highest number of staff being killed. And of course, the images of women, children, civilians, hospitals, schools, residential areas being attacked is really quite dramatic. So when we look at that and we look at our leadership in countries, the humanitarian country teams as the humanitarian coordinators, what can we do practically to kind of bring the question of protection of civilians within the humanitarian, you know, sphere of work into attention, into action? What could they do?
That's a really good question. Look, I was in Eastern Chad about 2 months ago, and this was the rainy season. So normally the flow of Sudanese refugees should have died down to a trickle because of the rainy season. The roads become impassable and it's very difficult, but they, you know, for them to cross. But despite all of the, you know, weather hazards, they were still coming through. And I was at this reception center at the border. And I was, you know, I was talking to some of these people coming through. And I was with some of our protection colleagues. And you realize that 80% of the Sudanese refugees coming in are women and children. Mm. Out of them, 70% have been subject to some form of sexual violence or another. Because we all know sexual violence has now become a weapon of war. Certainly happening in Sudan. We also know it was happening in other, you know, the DRC and other, you know, critical conflict-ridden countries as well. And I asked my protection colleague, I said, so how many of these survivors of GBV are we able to reach through our GBV programs? And she said, less than 10%. I had an 80-year-old woman telling me how she had been repeatedly raped in the most banal, matter-of-fact terms, as if this was something that happened to everybody. She had a 14-year-old grandson who was with her. He was crying. She was not.
Wow.
And this is, you know, this really, I mean, I had to say in my 30 plus years of being in the humanitarian field, this had to be the most harrowing experience ever, listening to these women. Yeah. I heard another 16-year-old girl who was repeatedly raped, who had to step over her brother's dead body and then, you know, wow, to flee from Sudan. So these are almost commonplace stories. So what can we do to help? One, and I have said this to all our donors everywhere in practically every different forum, money is essential. These people, these women and these girls were being left without any form of support. As I said, the protection colleagues said, we are reaching only, you know, less than 10% of these people through our programs. Not because the Chadian government didn't want to provide those services, not because UNICEF and its partners didn't want to provide the services, simply because of a lack of funding. Because we all know that the Sudan situation is one of the most egregiously underfunded. We normally, the, you know, Sudan regional response plan is funded at around 27% on any given year. So a lot of these people were literally sitting around waiting for services that were not happening. So key thing, absolutely, it has to be funding. And that has to come in. The second thing, of course, leaving aside all the political solutions, is this advocacy. And we can never underestimate the power of a coalition of like-minded actors, member states, critical, you know, faith-based organizations, people and entities that have influence from the grassroots level to government level to international levels, bringing them all together in like-minded coalitions to advocate for this. You know, we can't do it alone. One of the first things you learn as a protection officer is UNHCR is not alone in this. Partnerships are key. We can be the catalyst. We can bring the actors together. But at the end of the day, like I said before, we can't do everything for everybody everywhere all at once. We have to ensure that other partners are brought in, that they all have clear roles and, you know, parts to play, that it's all done in a coordinated way, and that in a refugee situation is our role. But at the end of the day, it has to be that something done in partnership, whether it's on advocacy, whether it's on program delivery. UNHCR never does this alone. We have never done it alone in our 75 years. It's always been with partners. So partnerships are key. Advocacy is key. Courage, conviction, consistency in advocating messages, and really clarity as well. Keep your messages short and simple. Don't go into technical legal details that nobody is interested in. They need to know, yes, 80% coming in, women and children, 70% survivors are GBV, less than 10% are being reached through our programs. Something fundamentally wrong there. We need to address that. And these are the solutions that we are proposing. Those should be the kinds of advocacy messages we're sending out.
Collision building and of like-minded people and coming up with advocacy, really important at the humanitarian country team, at the country level. And how about if they need to mobilize New York or Geneva, or how could they go? Sometimes the message is very difficult to give it at the country level. What can they do to look at alliances broaden within the system?
This is where, for example, the IAC is there for that. You know, that part of the humanitarian reset is also looking at, you know, one of the work streams is humanitarian diplomacy. And that is essentially, again, to put it in a nutshell, all of the IAC principles, which is the entire international humanitarian community, speaking from the same song sheet in terms of different operations or in terms of different priorities, whether it's GBV for Sudan or, you know, access to shelter in another operation, that all of them are speaking with the same voice, you know, with the same voice and basically communicating exactly the same messages. Consistency is key. You know, governments at the international level do need to hear the same message. If we come with conflicting messages, then we destroy our own credibility and undermine the, you know, the protection and safety of the people we are trying to serve. So it's really that. It's escalating it, but jointly to New York levels or to capital levels as well.
Great. So Reuven, we're living at a time where financial resources this year were significantly cut. We really saw, first of all, programs closing down, offices closing down, significant staff reduction, not just UNHCR, the whole humanitarian system, other UNAIDS, NGOs, everybody. So my question is, at times of reduced financial resources, how do we ensure that protection is at the center, both in terms of programs and, of course, advocacy, to be able really to put the most vulnerable of the most vulnerable people that we serve at the heart of our response?
It's true. I think all of us are grappling with this right now. It's not, of course, not just UNHCR. And it's almost like a death by a thousand cuts, because that's what's happening right now. I mean, last year, you know, our global budget was $5 billion. So we were a $5 billion agency. This year, our global budget is about $3.7 billion. And next year, in the best case scenario, it's probably going to be around $2.9 billion. So we have lost a dramatic amount of funding. But that also means that that has already had a massive impact, as you said yourself, Banas, on our operations on the ground. We've lost over 5,000 of our workforce, and we'll probably lose many more. We've had to either reduce, shut down, or reconfigure our presence in 185 locations. And, you know, protection sectors have been hugely impacted as well. We've lost about 28% of our, you know, protection and solutions workforce. We've had to reduce our GBV programs by 38%. Health and education programs are, you know, have been reduced by close to 90%. In an ideal world, when we walk away from doing certain activities because we no longer have the funding to do it, we try to hand it over in a sustainable way to other partners for them to carry on. But in today's world, that's not happening because our partners are in exactly the same financial boat that we are in. So we have now had to encounter these incredibly difficult situations where we are literally walking away from activities, knowing that there's no other agency or partner that's going to be picking it up, that we are literally leaving gaps in assistance coverage because none of us have the funding to be able to do it. So, and that's brought us to, you know, this term that's been used right now, really horrible one in the UN circles, which is called hyper-prioritization.
Wow.
So having initially come up at the beginning of this year with a list of priorities, we realize now going into next year that we're going to have even less funding than we had this year. So we need to now choose amongst those priorities. And this comes back to your question, Panos. How do we do that? It's essentially, and this is where data facts are our friends, because it's through that you look at what needs to be done critically, what is absolutely life-saving that needs to happen at any point. And then you focus on those in some of those humanitarian operations that we're going to be looking at. It's life-saving protection services. And then, you know, if we have money for funding for other activities, then you add it on. But protection has to be the core of this. It has to be something that's essentially going to be effectively the thing that services that provide refugees with protection of being against being forcibly returned to where they came from, one, and not being completely destitute or dying in their countries of asylum because of a lack of assistance or proper protection services. So it's really that. It's as fundamental as that. Of course, it sounds easy to say that. It's much more difficult to implement it on the ground. But it's also very context specific as well. I mean, in our presence in high income countries, we are obviously not looking at life-saving assistance, you know, operations. In those countries, we really are looking at advocacy. Again, looking at some of these critical legislative changes that are happening in Europe, in the United States, and other, you know, countries in the global north, it's for our officers there to really focus on advocating to ensure that whatever critical legislation is being passed actually does have refugee protection at its core. So these are some of the concrete priorities that we really need to be looking at, but again, very context specific, of course. But the other thing is, of again, what I've said, it's partnerships as well. It's not us doing everything on our own. It's building up those critical coalitions. As you said, coalition building is something that's absolutely critical that we really need to do.
Right. Reuven, my final question. We've always said protection is everybody's business in our sector. So my question is, from a practical term, how do we make it happen in today's complex world and context that, as you've described it?
You know what? Again, we really need to demystify what protection is all about, because everybody gets scared of that term. And I still see it for program people, people dealing with, you know, our technical experts dealing with shelter, education, health. They're all going to go, oh, protection, because for them, it's something that a whole bunch of lawyers sitting in a room are doing. It's not. It's, as I said from the start, everything we do has protection at its core, whether it's devising shelter that really take into account the specific needs of certain categories of refugees, whether it's education that's tailoring the needs, you know, child protection needs, registration, that simple piece of paper that, or, you know, name in a computer system that actually basically gives a refugee an identity, tells them that they have the right to exist, and critically gives them access to services. That's not just a protection tool, that's a life-saving tool. Everybody has protection at the heart of what they're doing, whichever functional discipline you belong to. And I keep saying this to everybody that I meet in operations. Protection is 99% common sense, particularly for your protection, and literally 1% knowledge of law and policy. You know, again, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that women heads of households need to be identified quickly, that their needs need to be looked at as a priority. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. You don't have to be a lawyer to know that. That's just plain common sense. You don't need to be, again, Einstein to know that unaccompanied and separated children need to be identified immediately, need to be put into a proper care system, and that their needs need to be looked at. You know, this is common sense. This is not something that is just within the remit of protection staff or with staff with protection in their titles. It's really the job of everybody. And this is really, and I say this as well, and I think said it in a different podcast as well, what sets UNHCR apart from every other humanitarian agency is our refugee protection mandate. And whatever the funding condition, you know, circumstances are, yes, financial contributions may be voluntary. Our refugee protection mandate is not. It is mandatory. It is what we do. It is what sets us apart from every other agency. A lot of other agencies can do shelter, they can do health, they can do education, they can, you know, do livelihoods, income generating programs. There's literally only one agency that's mandated to do refugee protection, that's us. And I have to say, in the most critical protection situations, it's UNHCR against the rest of the world. When we have to go to a host government saying, please, host government, accept these hundreds of thousands of refugees who are at your border, you're not going to find a whole lot of other agencies accompanying us to those meetings. They're going to say, well, you know what, UNHCR, that's your job. You go and advocate to make sure that 1.2 million Sudanese refugees come into Chad. That's your job. Once they're in Chad, we'll help you. But that's advocacy, that's your thing. When it comes to, you know, going to an immigration detention center and talking to the immigration authorities saying you need to release these asylum seekers and refugees, or at worst, you need to ensure that they have proper legal counseling and access to assistance, access to interpretation, access to decent conditions if they are being detained. Again, we are the only ones who are doing it. No other UN agency is going to come with us on those ones. That is literally our DNA. That is what we do. It's not the easy thing. It's not the popular thing. But this is what we were mandated to do. And this is at the heart of what we are about. You know, for UNICEF staff, and Panos, you know this because you were part of the UNICEF workforce, it's never been a 9-to-5 job. It's never been about the paycheck. We have had representatives been declared persona non grata more times than I care to remember. And that is because they were doing the job. They were doing the right thing, even if it was the most unpopular thing, even if it was the most politically complicated thing that resulted in them being, you know, declared persona non grata and being asked to leave that country. And that's a badge of courage for many of us because of the fact that that shows we did something right. And at the end of the day, that is what matters. Protection is at the heart of what we do. It is everybody's job in UNHCR. It's the 15,000 workforce in UNHCR. That is what we do. That's what sets us apart from the rest of the world.
Thank you. Thank you, Reuven. Thank you for really sharing with us your insights. What a delight to hear your analytical, your depth reflections, also strategic from where you are as the Assistant High Commissioner of Protection. So really, we appreciate it having with you in this program. And I'd like to say to you, to our callers, to our listeners, thank you really for joining us on the podcast. We would like to hear from you. So write to us at the GELI website. Also wanted to let you know that as GELI, in partnership actually with UNHCR, we provide support missions to humanitarian country teams on development on the centrality of protection and strategy. So if you're interested, please reach out to us and we'll be happy to have a call and see how to take it forward. So with that, thank you and see you in the next episode. Bye-bye.